Hey guys, welcome to the NCS podcast. Today's topic is maintaining hope for the kingdom of God. Our friend Jack will be reading from 2 Samuel 2.
In the course of time, David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go up to one of the towns of Judah?" he asked. The Lord said, "Go up." David asked, "Where shall I go?" "To Hebron," the Lord answered. So David went up there with his two wives, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. David also took the men who were with him, each with his family, and they settled in Hebron and its towns. Then the men of Judah came to Hebron, and there they anointed David king over the tribe of Judah. When David told that it was the men from Jabesh Gilead who had buried Saul, he sent messages to them to say to them, "The Lord bless you for showing this kindness to Saul, your master, by burying him. May the Lord now show you kindness and faithfulness, and I, too, will show you the same favor because you have done this. Now then, be strong and brave, for Saul, your master, is dead, and the people of Judah have anointed me king over them." Meanwhile, Abner, son of Ner, the commander of Saul's army, has taken Ish-bosheth, son of Saul, and brought him over to Mananiah. He set him king over Gilead, Ashuri, and Jezreel, and also over Ephraim, Benjamin, and all Israel. Ish-bosheth, son of Saul, was 40 years old when he became king over Israel, and he reigned for 2 years. The tribe of Judah, however, remained loyal to David. The length of time David was king in Hebron over Judah was 7 years and 6 months.
Be good if you can keep 2 Samuel open. On the screen, you'll see a couple of images of three men, different in various ways, but similar, I think, in one way. I don't know how much you know about Barack Obama and Kevin Rudd. Obviously, Trump is more recent in our minds. But these three men have one thing in common, as much as they've got many differences. The thing in common, I think, is that they were just experts at galvanizing a following, maybe unexpectedly, and bringing people with them to the point where at least two out of the three unexpectedly elected. And this just sort of uprising, this wave of interest in them and their parties. Kevin Rudd's known as the one who kind of made the most of social media for the first time in Australian politics and just gathered these huge numbers of people behind him. And similar with the other two men, galvanized followers as leaders and brought people with them on a journey to the point where they became the president or the prime minister of their respective countries. But what's happened to these people now? What's happened to these people now? I was scrolling on Facebook the other day and saw an ad for an organization called Crimson Global Academy, I think it was. It's a school that's online completely. Students in Australia can access it. And guess who the speech night kind of presenter was? It was Kevin Rudd. That's where he is now. You know, famous school maybe, but not the Prime Minister of Australia kind of level of popularity at this point. Many of their changes that they made in their tenures as politicians have been turned back by successive governments. Many have been overturned by Supreme Courts or may well be in the current phase of American politics. Many of their things that they've done have been ignored by the bureaucrats that were tasked with making them happen. I don't know if you've seen the Netflix show Utopia. I've watched Utopia this week, earlier in the week. I was sick, and when I'm sick, I often just a few Netflix shows is the thing I do. This is Utopia, and these guys work for, I think it's called the Nation Building Authority, and their task is to build the nation. They get government directives to go and do that, and really in the end, all they do is nothing. They make it look like the government is doing something, and so the government can say, we're announcing a rail link from Melbourne to Brisbane via Sydney, or some big plan like that. And we've handed it over to the Nation Building Authority to make it happen. Everyone goes, "Ooh, that sounds very real. And they're like, I'm ready for it. I'm ready to catch the train." And what do? Well, they change their own logo a bunch of times. They talk amongst themselves. They build a new website for themselves and do absolutely nothing else. Internal politics comes up. But again, they don't build any rail lines and don't build any buildings. They do scoping studies and feasibility studies and no work that has any real merit or visibility. I wonder if, as you think about government, as you think about leaders of our nation, or maybe leaders in your life, that maybe you're a bit cynical like that as well. of what they can and have and will achieve. You know, good things do get done, but as we think about these different protest movements or peacemaking movements or end poverty campaigns or climate activism, does anything really significantly change in the end? Does anything really significantly change in the end? Poverty is still rife throughout our world. Child slavery remains. Displacement, war, they're not just realities of a past age, they're realities of our age across our world even at the moment. Think of Ukraine, think of Sri Lanka, think of Myanmar, places where it's just horrible for people to be living. Political coups, opposition, all sorts of things. So there's a good news story, some new thing that's happening, and it's often countered by a bad one. It's why newspapers, the front covers so often have two sections, the top section, the good news story, and then the bottom section, some corruption scandal. We get let down. We get let down by our leaders. Leaders so often fail us. Leaders so often fail us. We need more. We need more than just the leaders that these people are. We need more than leaders that even we could be, because we know ourselves that we wouldn't always succeed in their position. They put their hope in some kind of leader. God's people in the Old Testament, God's people in the time of 2 Samuel, which we're looking at, put their hope in a leader as well. They put their hope in the leader Saul, tall, strong, powerful. They put their hope in him to overthrow the Philistines. And Saul, as we saw last week, fell on his sword. That was the end of Saul, with his sons there, dead. They need a better leader. They're not dissimilar to us in many ways. And the question I think they would have been asking at that time, and maybe you're asking as well, is will God answer their need? Will God act on their behalf? Will God act for them, or has he forgotten? Has God forgotten us? Has he forgotten the people around our world who are just struggling so much in their various circumstances? Has God forgotten his people here? Well, let's jump into the story. We're in 2 Samuel, chapter 2. And really, this is a transition point in the story. Saul was the people's king, but Saul has died, and David's been the king in waiting for probably about 13 years at this point. Now, just imagine that. You're tasked with being the future leader, even if it's only of your little jurisdiction, and you've got to wait 13 years for that to become a reality. That's a long, long time, especially when you're talking about a future king. See, Saul had been disobedient to God, and so he was going to be taken down. He was going to lose the throne. And David gets anointed to be king well before he actually becomes king. This long period of time, and the wait's not easy for him. Saul made David his enemy, went out of his way to get David, to take him out of the picture. But David did not make Saul his enemy. Saul made David his enemy, but David did not make Saul his enemy. He escaped and he ran from Saul, but he didn't oppose his appointment as king or his rule. He could have killed Saul, as we see on the screen, one passage here in 1 Samuel 24. This is an opportunity he had in a cave to take Saul's life. And reflecting on that, now speaking to Saul in this bit, he says, "Behold, this day your eyes have seen how the Lord gave you today into my hand in the cave. And some told me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, I will not put out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed." Or a bit further down in verse 12, David says, "May the Lord judge between me and you. May the Lord avenge me against you, but my hand shall not be against you. My hand shall not be against you." For Saul made David his enemy, but David did not make Saul his enemy. He remained loyal to him as the Lord's anointed, even though he knew that Saul's time was short, even though he knew that he himself would be the next one to rule. As we think about this king, the chosen king, Saul was the king that the people asked for. In fact, that's what his name, Sha'ul, means, to be asked for. The people asked Samuel to put a king over them, and Saul was chosen. They wanted to be like the other nations, is the reason they give. A king like the other nations, as you see in 1 Samuel 8 a little bit earlier. And so this man, the asked-for one, is appointed as their king. And he's appointed as their king in place of God as their king, who they rejected. That's how it's described. They have not rejected you, God says, but they have rejected me from being king over them. And we need to think about this for a moment, because if we read the story closely, we notice God also appointed Saul as king. The people asked for him, but God accommodated to their request, warned them that it wouldn't go well for them, but then placed Saul as king over them. Saul's ascension was this act of accommodation by God, who warned them what would happen, painfully allowed his people to reject him, and then bear the consequences of that decision. He even sovereignly guided the selection of Saul as the man, as the particular king, of his own replacement, if you like. God's their king, he's the one ruling over them, and then Saul is placed in his place. He was to be a king like all the other kings of the nations. That's what they wanted to be like. A king able to lead them and able to defeat the Philistines. And yet all along, God knows and warns them of the consequences of that. Saul's the king the people asked for, and so he's chosen in that sense, but he's not the chosen king. Notice the differences as we come to 2 Samuel 2, in how David comes to the throne. 2 Samuel 2. After this, after Saul's death, David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah?" And the Lord said to him, "Go up." David said, "To which shall I go up?" And he said, "To Hebron." So David went up there, and his two wives also, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And David brought up his men who were with him, everyone with his household, and they lived in the towns of Hebron. And the men, or the elders or leaders of Judah, came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. David asks. Saul was the asked for king. David asks. He immediately inquires of the Lord. He could have surely just taken the throne at this point. People knew him to be the next king. He had his own backers and army. But David asks about the timing, "Shall I go?" And about the place, "To which place shall I go? Which place shall I rule from?" And the Lord's answer is interesting. I expected to read, "Go to Jerusalem." But says, "Go up to Hebron." Why Hebron? Why Hebron? Is Hebron maybe a strategic military location? It'd be a good place to fight from? Or is it where Saul reigned from? Or maybe it's where David's family's from? All reasons that people would choose a place to rule from. Hebron is none of those things. My only recollection of Hebron when I heard this and read this was, I've heard of that before, and then I thought, actually, I've got a glass vase at home, which is made of Hebron glass. That's not why Saul ruled from there either. What Hebron does here, and David's instruction by God to go to Hebron, is it connects David into a much, much bigger story. Because as we look back in Genesis 13, right after God promises to Abraham to be a blessing to the nations, where does Abram end up? He ends up in Hebron, by the oaks of Mamre. Abram enters the promised land occupied by the Canaanites, and he pitches his tent and builds an altar to Yahweh the Lord at Hebron. And then a bit further on in Genesis 23, we see this. Abram's given this large field and trees and a cave, I think by the Hittites here. Why? So he can bury his now deceased wife Sarai at this place. Why there does he do that? Well, Genesis 35 maybe gives us the reason. Hebron's said to be the place where Abram dwelt, where he sojourned in the land. It was where Isaac, his son, had died, where Isaac was buried by Esau and Jacob. It's where Jacob, or later called Israel, is dwelling in the promised land. So this is the place they take up their residence, if you like. Abram has obeyed the Lord to go there, and he sets up his place, the Lord's place, to be a blessing to the nations, beginning at Hebron. It's the place that begins to see the fulfillment of God's promise. The promise to rebuild a nation from this little spot down here. David will become king in Hebron, there. Because he's part of and a climax to this story, Abram's story, to be a blessing to the nations. David is to take on that role as the blessed person to lead a blessed people to be a blessed nation in order to be a blessing to the other nations. And so verse 2 and 3, David goes up and he obeys the Lord in doing so and takes everyone with him. Now, we just kind of read past that and think, well, that's what he'd do, right? But remember, there's Philistines around. It's not so easy. It's dangerous. To take up everyone with you, your whole family and all the people, that's dangerous. He doesn't go and scope it out first. He trusts the Lord and he goes. He's waited for this point. He's waited for God's timing. Everyone, verse 3, with his household goes up there. And the men, verse 4, or the elders of Judah came and they anointed David king over the house of Judah. After those 13 long years, troublesome years for David. But notice he's only the king over the house of Judah. Just one tribe amongst the people. What about all the other tribes? Saul had led all Israel, and David, just one tribe. And then the Philistines remain a constant threat externally as well. As we think about leadership changes in our world, it's probably a smaller version of what's happened back then. Leadership changes often bring with them constant threat and the chances of opposition to pop up, rival rulers pop up at that point, taking opportunities to take the throne or whatever it may be. Internal family power plays come to light. The challenges for David have only just begun, and he's just began to reign. He's waited. He hasn't taken premature steps to become king. He's asked the Lord. He's honored the Lord's plan. Well, let's see what happens next. David's first act as king from halfway through verse 4. When they, the men, or again, elders of Judah, told David, it was the men of Jabesh Gilead who buried Saul. David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh Gilead and said to them, may you be blessed by the Lord because you showed this loyalty to Saul, your Lord, and buried him. Now may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you, and I will do good to you because you have done this thing. Now therefore, let your hands be strong and be valiant, for Saul, your Lord, is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me king over them. What's David's first act as he become king, or first recorded act at least? It's to honor those who honored Saul. It's to honor those who honored Saul. Which, as you think about it, is incredible. Remember who Saul made David out to be? His enemy. And David does not treat Saul that way in retribution. David continues even after Saul is dead. We saw last week that he honored Saul in life. Now he honors Saul even in death by honoring the people of Jabesh Gilead, who go and give Saul a reasonable burial. See, Saul had rescued this people group, the people of Jabesh Gilead, in what was probably his first act as king. Now David honors them in his first act as king. He protects them from further shame. See, what had happened was the head of Saul and the sons had been dismembered off the wall of Beit Shan, and then these people came and they buried them at risk to themselves. If you flick back in your Bibles to the end of 1 Samuel, just a couple of pages, to chapter 31 and verse 11 to 12. When the residents of Jabesh Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all their warriors set out and traveled throughout the night. They took Saul's corpse and the corpses of his sons from the city wall of Beit Shan and went to Jabesh, where they burned them. They took the bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh. Then they fasted for 7 days. They respect, as best they can, given the circumstances, the body of Saul and his sons. They honor them at risk to themselves. They travel all night to do this. And for David, sending messages to them, the people of Jabesh Gilead, was also dangerous. The distance is great. Remember, this is Philistine-occupied territory, and off he sends them. They'd come and taken Israelite cities before the Philistines, yet David, despite this danger to the people, is committed to seeing these people, the people of Jabesh Gilead, blessed by his rule, blessed by the Lord, ultimately. Remember, the people of Jabesh Gilead were likely tied pretty closely to Saul. And so they likely would have been seen themselves as enemies of David. They'd set themselves up that way, and David yet rewards them for the way they treat Saul, even in death. The Lord's anointed. What's the reward? Have a look in verse 5. First, he says he prays for them, a prayer for the Lord's anointed, to be blessed by the Lord. that the Lord would show exceeding kindness to them, verse 6. And then he answers his own prayer, it seems. I, the Lord's representative, I will do good to you. I will enact that blessing. David doesn't assume their allegiance here as he's become king. I don't think here he's trying to buy them back with this kindness. He's simply rewarding those who honor the Lord's anointed. God, through his chosen, rewards those who honor his chosen. So how do they respond? Well, there's no verse 8b or c really here. We don't find out. We don't find out how the people of Jabesh Gilead respond. Instead, we get verse 8, something different. Internal opposition. We've had the external opposition there. We've got internal opposition here, a rival rule. Abner, verse 8, son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, took Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. And he made him king over Gilead and the Asherites and Jezreel and Ephraim and Benjamin and all Israel. Notice how all these places are listed and David is king over Judah. Verse 10, Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel, and he reigned 2 years. But the house of Judah followed David, and the time David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. This is rival rule. This is a rival rule set up against the rule of God's anointed. Abner here is powerful and opportunistic. Abner is Saul's cousin, now dead Saul's cousin. Abner's alive, Saul's the one who died. And he was commander of Saul's army. But think about what's happened there. His master, who had all the power, who put him in charge as commander, is now dead. And so Abner's role, his power, is basically tied to Saul, who doesn't exist anymore in life. And so Abner has lost all his power. So he sees a time to act, to gain power again, or to hold on to whatever he has. This is a rejection of David's rightful rule, God-appointed rule. Now, possibly we can give Abner the benefit of the doubt and think, well, maybe he wanted Saul's dynasty to continue and he's being honourable in that way. But I think that's too positive a reading. I think he just wants to maintain his own power. He's been commander of this huge army, and now what will happen to him? Joab's David's commander, not Abner. And so Abner acts to maintain power. And how does he do it? Well, he gets Saul's mystery fourth son. If you hear last week, you heard about the three sons of Saul, and they died, as if that was all the sons of Saul. But now we meet a fourth son of Saul, and he makes him a rival king. His name's Ish-bosheth, or that's really a nickname. It's Ish-baal, if you his proper name. Now, Ish-bosheth means man of shame. If you think about names for your children in the future, don't go with anything like this. Ish-bosheth, man of shame. He rules from Mahanaim, which is a strategic location. You might be able to find it on the map. And he rules over all the northern region tribes. All Israel, the narrator is clear to point out. All except that tribe of Judah. He seems really powerful here, Ish-bosheth. But he's not. Abner is the powerful one. He's put Ish-bosheth, the unknown son of Saul, as like a puppet king to rule. Abner, verse 9, made him king. He's presented as passive here. And his reign's only just a couple of years, which means there's 5 years, probably a bit before and some after, that these tribes have no king, which suggests that the Philistines are probably pretty active. And Abner is basically taking charge of the people as the commander of the army. And so what we have is this situation of a divided kingdom. Right as the chosen ruler that God has appointed, David, has been established as king. Immediately, there's division in the kingdom, even before it really divides later on. And there remains this prospect of this internal civil war between the tribes in the north and Judah. And all the while, there's also the threats of external conflict. You've got the Philistines active, Saul's arch rivals. So verse 12, we see the civil war then ensue. Abner, the son of Ner, the servants of Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out and met them at the pool of Gibeon. And they sat down there, the one on the one side of the pool and the other on the other side of the pool. Now, just talk to the person next to you for a moment, and I want you to describe what you're picturing as you hear that read. What's the picture? What's happening? What's the pool look like? Who's there? What kind of feeling have you got? Go for it. Well, let's see what happens. It does kind of sound like the setup for this lovely poolside resort with some entertainment, and there is entertainment if you want to call it that. Verse 14, Abner said to Joab, "Let the young men arise," verse 14, "and compete before us." So it depends how you read that, as entertainment or not, and how Roman you are. "Let them arise," Joab said. Verse 15, 12 from each side are chosen for this battle, which does have kind of a gladiatorial representative number sense. If 12 from each side are chosen, I don't know, I'm assuming they don't battle in the pool. I'm assuming that's they go near it. But pretty quickly, if it was ever entertainment, it turns pretty gruesome. Verse 16, they put them in each other in headlocks and jam swords in each other's sides. And then verse 17, it's called a fierce battle, which David's servants won. But one of David's men, Joab's brother, so Joab, the commander of his army, his brother Asahel, he wants more. Verse 18, he knows he's as fast as a wild gazelle. And he chases Abner. Now remember, Abner's the power guy, Saul's commander. But Asahel is fixated on taking him down. Maybe he's fixated by the pride of, I'm going to get the general of the other army. Maybe that. Maybe he just likes the fact he's fast and he wants to show off his fastness. But what happens, it's kind of comical, verse 20, Abner stops and turns and talks to him. Is that you, Asahel? Verse 21, turn aside from following me. Take one of my servants and his armor. And Asahel, he's probably infuriated at this point, determined to kill, but it seems he's basically powerless. Like, why doesn't he take that opportunity to kill him? Maybe he probably can't. There's nothing he can really do against this warrior who may have others with him. And Abner calmly is trying to redirect him. It's like, it felt to me like what I might do when my one-year-old tries to grab my glasses off my face and scratch me. And I just go, Joey, look at Evie. Look at Evie. She's small. Go get her. Like, that's kind of the scene that I feel like is going on here. Go get her squeaky toy. Look at the other soldier. Verse 21, Asahel would not turn aside from following him. And so Abner tries a different approach, verse 22. And basically, to paraphrase this approach, it's stop, you know I could kill you. And if I did that, well, how then could I present myself or lift up my head before your brother Joab? Verse 23, Asahel still won't give up. Therefore, Abner struck him in the stomach with the butt of his spear so that the spear came out at his back. And he fell there and died where he was, and all who came to the place where Asahel had fallen and died stood still. It's not a pretty end. And then the brothers, Asahel's brothers, Joab and Abishai, hear about this, and so they get angry and they pursue Abner for the rest of the day, but they're probably not as fast as the wild gazelle brother. Verse 25, Abner's ready. The people of Benjamin, so they're on his side, gathered together behind Abner and became one group and took their stand on the top of a hill. And imagine that's pretty scary when you notice that the person you're chasing actually has a whole army gathered. No, maybe I stop and don't keep going at this point. And so what began as this grab for power by Abner and then this battle of 12 versus 12 now looks like becoming this mass-scale civil war amongst God's chosen people, in God's chosen promised land, as soon as God's chosen king has been enthroned as king. And yet there's another twist, verse 26. Abner the negotiator tries another approach. He tries to stop the fighting. Verse 26, Abner called to Joab, "Shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that the end will be bitter? How long will it be before you tell your people to turn from the pursuit of their brothers?" And Joab said, "As God lives, if you had not spoken, surely the men would not have given up their pursuit of their brothers until the morning." So Joab blew the trumpet, and all the men stopped and pursued Israel no more, nor did they fight anymore. It's fascinating that that is even possible and happened, but that's what happens. And each of the armies then return home and they count their losses. And we get the numbers there, verse 29 to 30 and down in 32. David's servant, led by Joab and his men, there's 20 who have fallen, 20 died, including Asahel, Joab's brother. But Abner, on his side, loses 360 of the Benjamites, one of the tribes. And so you'd say, well, David won, right? 20, 360. He wins numerically. But his commander, Joab, hates Abner at this point for killing Asahel, his brother. And so this hatred, this battle will surely resurface. It's just left there hanging in the narrative for now. right through this battle scene, it's really interesting how David is presented. He seems to be presented as somewhat distant from the battle. And at one level, you think, well, he's king. He should be bearing the responsibility of everything that happens by Joab, his commander, and the tribes. And that's true. But I think here, David is being presented as distant for a reason. Joab and Asahel, they're the ones making the decisions to respond. And it seems to fit with how David has treated Saul throughout his lifetime and even in his death. David has waited for Saul to die, waited for God to give him the throne as king. David's waiting now for God to extend that rule over all the nations, not trying to take it prematurely. And so then the question comes, what are we to make of an account like this for us? What are we to make of an account like this for us as we think about human leaders and their failures and the hopes and expectations we place in them? Maybe this is an account that just is we should adjust our expectations of leadership or of God's plans for us to include maybe more frustration and trouble and waiting like David went through. Maybe we think, well, this is a reminder just to be patient like David is. It's an exemplary example of patience, 13 years to wait and then more. Or maybe it's a call to be a little more like Abner in negotiation, negotiate for peace rather than go to war. And they're all reasonable, possible things too we can think about from this. But if we draw any of those conclusions without thinking about how this fits into that big story, the story that began with Abram at Hebron and then David at Hebron, and where that story goes, I think we're going to miss the most important conclusions that come from a story like this, that come from a book like 2 Samuel. In Matthew's account of the life of Jesus, this is how it begins. The first verse of Matthew, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. What's Matthew doing here? He's connecting Jesus to that story, to David's story, right back to Abraham's story. He's connecting Jesus to the Hebron story, as we've seen in this story. Abram, the guy from Hebron, David, the guy who ruled from Hebron, Jesus is the son from their line, connected to their story, which is actually God's story about the promised blessed kingdom. Remember Abram, be blessed to be a blessing to the nations. And so we need to think, well, how does Jesus fit into that story? Well, who is he? And how does David show us something of who Jesus is? Because David in the New Testament, like here, is presented as this shadow, this anticipation of the king to come, Jesus. And I think we can think about that, David, as like a prototype and anticipation in a bunch of different ways. A couple from this story. One is obedience. David's obedience, David's waiting for God, immediately asking God, is it time? Where shall I go to become king? David obeys. And 1,000 years later, with David the shadow having ultimately failed in obedience later on, Jesus comes along and he's perfectly obedient right through his life, even unto the point of death on a cross. And so David's obedience becomes this shadow of greater obedience of the greater King Jesus. Well, we think of David's extraordinary kindness in this story, kindness to those who would set themselves up as enemies of God's anointed, the people of Jabesh-Gilead. As the example here, David honors them for honoring Saul. He goes out of his way at great risk to himself so that they might be honored, to show them great kindness. But again, this is just a shadow of the much greater, much more extraordinary kindness we find in King Jesus. Have a look at these words in Romans 5. You see, just at the right time, when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. A little bit later on, but God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Since we've now been justified by his blood, how much more shall we be saved from God's wrath through him? For if while we were God's enemies, we were reconciled to him through the death of his son, how much more, having been reconciled, shall we be saved through his life? Those words in yellow there. All really synonyms of being enemies, being the opposition. And yet in that place, that time when we were that, those things, God shows his extraordinary kindness to us in King Jesus, who comes and would even die in our place. And so we, these ungodly sinners, enemies, strong language, we align ourselves with all sorts of ideologies, ways of thinking, even people who go against God. We set ourselves up as enemies of God. That's the story of the Bible. We set ourselves up as the opposition to God, the opposition to God's king. And yet, whilst we do that, God sends his son. He makes himself, Jesus makes himself the man of shame, the Ishbosheth, the man of shame, so that we might not bear the shame and guilt of the actions that we have done, our opposition to God. Extraordinary kindness. The third thing I think we see as a shadow here is just the reality that's the frustration of the rule of God's king. David's time as king, it's not as rosy as we might care to think if we just look at the key passages in the Bible. We see stories like this and think, 13 years of waiting and then opposition. There's frustration to the reality of God's kingdom coming to bear. And we see that even in Jesus' life. The opposition that comes to Jesus from even the most religious people, and like the Pharisees, and then of course the Romans, and even to the point of his death. There's frustration from opposition. Now think about our time. We might not think in terms of kings and kingdoms and setting ourselves up as an alternate kingdom to God. We don't think in that language very often. But the idea of kingdoms is not actually far from how we think. It's just we don't use those words. Think about how ideas and ideologies are presented in our time. People have to pledge their allegiance in our culture to a particular idea, a particular way of thinking. And what happens if you go against that? Well, you're excluded, excommunicated, you're kicked out of the kingdom, if you like. We see this kingdom mentality when we don't submit to the status quo of our culture. Removal, punishment even. It's the things that happen in kingdoms. And you've seen an example of this being played out this whole week in the story of the seven players from the Manly Sea Eagles rugby league team. And if you followed the story, but basically, there's an idea that is driving a movement, and these seven players have decided that they will not stand for that, and they are basically being excluded as a result. Now, there's more to the story than that, and the story is changing every day, but basically it's an example of an idea that's been set up, and these people saying, actually, we won't stand for all that entails, and they're being excluded as a result. An idea that's become like a kingdom in how we treat it. For David, the way of God's kingdom is frustrated. Opposing armies, alternate rulers that set themselves up. And for Jesus, it's the same. The way of God's kingdom was frustrated. What about for us today? What about for Christians today? How is the way of God's kingdom frustrated and frustrating sometimes? Well, it's the frustration of ideas that go against God's way. The opposing ideas of autonomy, setting ourselves up as self-rulers, people seeking our own rule, the all-reigning power of the modern self-defined self, setting ourselves up as anyone else can't reign over us. We won't take a king, even God's king. And just the general opposition to leadership that is godly. Even if the person doesn't set themselves up as against God's way, think about a rule like in Sri Lanka at the moment. It's not necessarily talking about a rule as against God's way explicitly, and yet the nature of the rule is completely against God's way. What's just happened over there, if you followed that story, is that the president, I believe, of the country has gathered his family. They've held the rein for quite some time, and they've worked out a way to siphon all of the public money, the taxation, into personal bank accounts rather than spending it on the people, and they've taken those accounts, and they're offshore accounts now. And he's now resigned as president because of the protests, skipped the country and begin spending all the money, which the people now have no access to. The people of the country are lining up for food and for fuel. This is opposition to God's way. It's not how God would have any leader lead. And we think maybe we'd be better if we were in their circumstance, but certainly we need to question that. We all need a better leader. We all need a better leader. Than that, than even we could be. And in Jesus, as we've seen, we have that better leader. Obedient, exceptionally, extraordinarily kind, living, dying, and even living again now to reign as king, even in this world, which is frustrating for us. And so let me ask you as we finish, is Jesus the leader that you are putting your hope in? Is Jesus the leader you're putting your hope in? Or is it someone else? Is it an idea? Is it a person that you are putting your hope and trust in, you're pledging your allegiance to? Because only Jesus will continue to reign and give the reward of this new kingdom. As he asked his disciples to pray, your kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. That's what we pray for. And that's what only is possible and answered in King Jesus. And so let me pray now that prayer, exactly what Jesus taught us to pray. Let's pray. Our great God and Father, we thank you for King Jesus. And we do pray that your kingdom shown and established in King Jesus will come. It will come here on earth as it is in heaven. The reality of your unobstructed rule in heaven will become the reality of what is life on earth. And ultimately we know that's a prayer that's saying, come, Lord Jesus. Come, King Jesus. And so we pray that now.